It's also a really special pleasure to have so many people in this room who had so much to do with this book and the ideas that came from the dissertation that this book was germinated on, which came out of my time here in Wisconsin. And so it's just been such a nice time to be back. It's a bit windy, but otherwise it's just as beautiful as it ever was. So once you publish a book, you get to do your victory tour, but actually once the book is gone, everybody asks you about your next project. And so what you end up doing is forgetting that you actually published a book until somebody invites you to give a talk, and then you get to revisit your book, which is very exciting. So thank you for the opportunity to do that today with all of you. Just my quick sales pitch. We printed out some discount flyers if you actually do want to buy the book. You can take a look at it right here. Borrowed that copy from Scott, so please don't take it. And today I want to talk about the entire book condensed. This is sort of the reduced Shakespeare version of my book. All right. And the research itself was motivated by two basic questions. First was just trying to understand what human trafficking looked like in Russia today. We hear a lot of reports. They generally tend to talk entirely about sex trafficking. And as you'll see from the research that I've done, this is not all that's going on there. And so we don't have a lot of very good data. And so part of this project was really just to figure out empirically what was happening on the ground. But the second part of the project is to understand much better how law enforcement agencies deal with this problem. And this is sort of the theoretical core of the book. As it turns out, after all the research I did on kind of what kinds of trafficking, that was mostly contained in one chapter of the book. But the kinds of things that Russian law enforcement is doing and the kinds of problems that they face really illuminate, I think, this study. And this is what I bring to the table, I hope, in understanding the way that law enforcement works. So these challenges are, of course, not unique to Russian law enforcement in some ways and are unique to Russian law enforcement in other ways. And so I'll be talking about that today. And these are the two things that we'll cover in the talk. So just to give you a sense of where all this data is coming from, I spent about a year in Russia doing field work, doing interviews with various law enforcement officials, NGO representatives, academics who worked on human trafficking, participant observation. I spent about 6 months at the International Organization for Migration, who at the time was running the biggest human trafficking project in Russia. That has since closed down. I also collected a database of over 5,000 Russian newspaper articles to try to trace them trace trafficking cases through the legal system in Russia. And that's what provided the real data on what kinds of trafficking are going on in Russia. My year of field work was followed up by several additional visits in 2009, 2012, 2014 to kind of catch up and make sure that nothing really major had changed in that time. And the only thing that really has changed is that work on trafficking has largely diminished over time. The organizations that were working on it before are no longer working on it for various financial reasons and because other things have come up. And then I supplemented that with documents from 102 court cases. So a little bit of background. Russia in 2000 signed the International Protocol on Human Trafficking, which is part of the Transnational Organized Crime Protocol, called the Protocol to Prevent, Suppress, and Punish Trafficking in Persons, especially Women and Children. Fortunately, it has a nickname, the Palermo Protocol, so when I refer to it, it will be as the Palermo Protocol. Russia, along with 117 other countries, signed this in 2000, and it went into force in 2003, at the exact same time that Russia passed its own law criminalizing human trafficking and the use of slave labor in two separate criminal code articles. Now, the protocol also suggests that they do a whole bunch of other things on prevention, on creating protection measures for victims, but the only thing the protocol really requires is criminalization, which Russia did do. This was pushed by domestic and international actors, including the police. And at the same time that these 2003 laws were passed in Russia, they also changed the laws on prostitution to make them more applicable, make them harsher, not for arresting people within prostitution, but those who organized it or recruited people into prostitution. So those who facilitated prostitution. Those were also made harsher in this same bill. So the text of the Russian law, just so we know what we're talking about, and this is also, I should say, the definitions that I used to collect the data on the cases. So I allowed the Russian legislative definition to define my universe of cases. Human trafficking, the purchase and sale of a human being or any transaction with respect to a human being, and similarly, recruitment, transportation, transfer, harboring, or receipt for the purpose of his or her exploitation. Use of slave labor, key aspects are highlighted here, using the labor of a person in respect to which authority is exercised, which is akin to ownership, and the person cannot refuse to carry out the work or services for reasons independent of him. And these, as I mentioned, are the ways that I've defined human trafficking. So anything that fit this definition that came up in the news media, I used as part of my database. All right. So just to give you a sense of the kind of trafficking that goes on in Russia today, there are really four types that I'll talk about: domestic sex trafficking, international sex trafficking, domestic and international labor trafficking, and child trafficking. Domestic sex trafficking occurs primarily for prostitution. The typical patterns are that women are recruited from bad families, families where nobody might look for them, they don't have a lot of friends, they're having a difficult time, and they're run by very small local organized crime groups, usually about four or five members of the trafficking ring. The women or girls who are recruited are told about prostitution as a great job or are somehow otherwise coerced into coming into being prostitutes. And it takes place in private hotels, saunas, apartments, those sorts of things. Many of the women sort of join up, and then the real problems start when they try to leave. The trafficker will say, oh no, we've accumulated so much amount of money in debt for having transported you, or you have racked up a number of fines because you haven't done what you're supposed to do. And then when the woman says, okay, I'm ready to leave this situation, that's when the pressure usually begins. Sometimes the women are sold from brothel owner to brothel owner within the same town, or from one town in one region to a different town in a different region. And that exchange of money is often what triggers law enforcement to see that trafficking has taken place. The reality is that much of the prostitution in Russia, in the way that it is coercive in having people enter prostitution, could actually be considered trafficking according to the Russian law. And those cases also fall into the larger set of data, but not the data that I'm going to talk about today. So international sex trafficking cases are the ones that everybody probably thinks about when they think about human trafficking in Russia. Women go abroad from Russia to Europe, Asia, the Middle East. Interestingly, though, these are not cases that law enforcement prosecutes that often. These are really difficult for law enforcement. The trafficking operations themselves are much more sophisticated. They take a lot of time to investigate, which, as you'll see, creates problems for law enforcement. The getting of information from international counterparts is actually quite complicated. It requires a whole bunch of bureaucracy that they're not always willing to engage in. And importantly, the exploitation doesn't take place on Russian soil. And so they feel that it's much more difficult to prove that exploitation has taken place without all that information from where they come, from where they've gone to. These trafficking rings are differentiated largely by having a much larger number of victims. So these are the ones where you're talking about, 30 to 200 victims over the course of number of years. They're much, much more sophisticated. When I've talked to various law enforcement agents, they'll talk about some of these cases, and the number of sort of case file documents are boxes and boxes and boxes and boxes. These are not, small cases that they can deal with in a sort of small way. An example of this kind of trafficking comes from these. This is actually a trafficking sentencing hearing that I attended. And These men, these two Russian men, had an Albanian partner. They were recruiting women from Russia who agreed to be prostitutes and sending them to the Albanian who lived in Spain. He would then distribute them to various different brothels throughout Europe. And at the time that the arrest took place, the Albanian business partner was visiting his Russian business partners and so got swept up in the arrest. Law enforcement was actually waiting for him to come. He was in the process of taking two new women to the airport to fly off to Spain to be distributed elsewhere. According to the Palermo Protocol, it doesn't matter if you consent to being a prostitute. If you are trafficked and exploitation occurs, then it still counts. So these men were convicted to 7 or 8 years in prison apiece, even though all of the women knew that they were going to be prostitutes, because this still counted as human trafficking. And then the next type of trafficking we have in Russia, and this I would like to just be really clear, is probably the most prevalent form of human trafficking in Russia is labor trafficking. It's sort of the least recognized by law enforcement, but probably the most prevalent. Domestic and international labor trafficking I've kind of smushed together because they're mostly exploited in the same industries and in the same sorts of ways. So you will see this happening with migrant workers who are brought into Russia in trafficking situations. You'll see migrant workers who are already in Russia be exploited in trafficking situations, and you'll see Russian men mostly who are homeless, alcoholic, or otherwise socially isolated, who are also brought into labor trafficking situations. The major sectors of the economy that you find this happening are agriculture, salvage, so picking through trash dumps for recyclable material that will be worth money, and factory work, domestic labor, mostly men doing domestic labor around the house, building things, doing like garden, putting together gardens, those sorts of things, and construction work. The sectors of the economy, of course, mirror pretty clearly the ones in which informal labor tends to be the most prevalent in the Russian economy, and also industries in which there's not that much oversight, there's not that much regulation. And of course, they keep people fairly isolated. If you're picking through a trash dump with looking for recyclable materials, you don't have a lot of people coming in and out of a trash dump. Likewise, in a big giant farm, people are very isolated. Even in cities, when people work in construction under slave labor conditions, you tend to see them living and existing primarily in the construction space rather than sort of going out within the city. One of the interesting things that I found, and this happens a lot in Russia, is that conscript soldiers get rented out by their commanders in exchange for something to, you know, a local person. One of them I remember was rented out in exchange for the use of a bulldozer. So his services were rented, I mean, it's kind of ironic actually. His services on the farm were rented out for the use of a bulldozer for the military folks to use for whatever they needed it for. That is almost never considered by law enforcement to be slave labor by the definition, even though it could very, very easily fit. And it, you know, is often referred to in the media as slave labor of soldiers. So I found that to be particularly interesting. Child trafficking. When I'm talking about child trafficking, I'm talking about illegal adoption. Mostly what happens is desperate parents are trying to sell off their children because they are unable to maintain them, they don't want to bear the costs, etc. But there are also more organized child trafficking rings in Russia in which people have access to maternity hospitals, convince women to give up their babies for adoption or just give them to the state into foster care. And those babies, they sort of launder the documents, and those babies then end up being sold. In this situation, this man here, Dmitry Olyanov, wanted to sell his 2-year-old daughter for $3,700. Fortunately, the police found out about this and posed as an undercover buyer and arrested him after the money exchanged hands. The story that the police officers gave him was that they needed organs for the police officer's sick child. And so, you know, after saying, like, are you sure, if I cut your daughter up and give the organs to other children, that's what I'm gonna do. Are you sure you still wanna sell your kid? He was like, yep. And the money exchanged hands. And so originally that was how law enforcement had to do this, because there was a concern that the original formulation of the law had excluded these forms of exchange without some kind of exploitation. Organ trafficking counts as exploitation, according to the law. They've since fixed the law so that any kind of monetary exchange where a human, a person, is an object of sale, then becomes included. So this is what we, this is sort of the array of things that we see for trafficking in Russia. There has been a lot of focus on child trafficking, in part because of a long history of concern about the buying and selling of babies in Russia to foreigners. So this really tends to resonate very strongly. This is probably a disproportionate focus on child trafficking for illegal adoption and selling of babies than is warranted given the size of that problem compared to the size of sex and labor trafficking. But nevertheless, that's the focus. So as part of the research, as I mentioned, I tracked cases through the Russian news media to see what happened to them. And the following picture here gives a sense of, and I'm sorry, it's very busy, but these are the different types of trafficking I just talked about. The following, it gives a sense of what law enforcement is pursuing over the years. This is not, I should say, official Ministry of the Interior data, MVD data. That data did not prove, I have that data, but it did not prove to be that useful to me because they don't really break down things in a way that is interesting. I don't think that it's as falsified as many other crime statistics in Russia. I think it's pretty accurate, but it doesn't break down according to type of trafficking. It doesn't break down according to perpetrators. It doesn't give you the number of victims. All the MVD data is just numbers of cases registered. So that didn't prove to be that useful for me. So I created my own database instead. These are cases that at some point had a human trafficking charge attached to them, which does not mean that they ended up being charged ultimately or prosecuted or convicted of human trafficking. But at some point, just that law enforcement had called them trafficking or use of slave labor. Almost 70% of these end up being domestic cases. So whether that's domestic labor trafficking, domestic sex trafficking, or child trafficking, all of which has been domestic, 70% of what law enforcement is pursuing is within Russia. The major caveat to this data collection effort is that this may not represent the way that trafficking actually happens in Russia. These are the things that law enforcement is called trafficking. And so it may not be sort of a perfect representation. I think it's a good representation of the types of trafficking, but the prevalence of each, I think, may be not entirely captured by this. But this leads us to the second part of the research about how law enforcement has dealt with human trafficking. Do we do questions at the end? I can't remember. Okay. I've been teaching for too long at this point. I always have to pause for questions. Okay, so a couple of major challenges for law enforcement in pursuing human trafficking cases. The first is uncovering the case. I won't talk as much about this today, but most law enforcement activity anywhere in the world is a direct response to a call, a direct response to a report by somebody, and it's reactive. And for many reasons that I probably don't have to elaborate tremendously on, victims of human trafficking are very hesitant to go to law enforcement. They may feel ashamed, they may feel embarrassed, they may be afraid of law enforcement. If you take, for example, labor trafficking victims who are migrants who are not legally in Russia, they may be very afraid to go to law enforcement. They may not have documents to even prove who they are. That happens with both domestic and international victims of human trafficking. They may not consider themselves to be victims at all. They may have considered this to be a job offer that they took that went horribly wrong. And that they were stupid and that they haven't been exploited, but they just got unlucky. And that's a really common feeling that a lot of these victims express. So uncovering the case has a number of problems, even sort of that moment of actually finding trafficking. But even if that happens, so all of those things are overcome, identifying the case as trafficking is actually very complicated for law enforcement. So when I'm talking about complication, I'm talking about both the formal criteria of the actual law, which I'll talk about in a second, but also informal criteria, which they apply to try to figure out what counts as trafficking and what doesn't count as trafficking. So these are the beliefs about what real trafficking looks like. If all that works out and they manage to identify the case as trafficking, there's still the issue of gathering the appropriate evidence to prosecute. And all of these things together are compounded very heavily by the incentive structure that exists in law enforcement institutions. So I'm going to talk about each of these parts. So I'm first going to focus on the formal criteria of the law. This is the trafficking law. So the top lists all the top set of boxes lists all the things that could be found as part of trafficking. What you see below that is all of the laws that could be applied to each of those stages, which would also be correct. So what this means is trafficking, as you can see, is a complex crime. If you just look at the number of things that could happen resulting in exploitation. Where you encounter that process as a law enforcement agent makes a huge difference in whether or not you see trafficking. Because if you encounter it at buying and selling, you're good. You've seen money exchange hands, the object of sale is a person, voila, trafficking, case closed. If you encounter it at the recruitment stage, however, you could see a lot of other crimes that are also defined as crimes in the criminal code. If you encounter it at any of these middle stages, so trafficking is this long process, right, in which almost all of the, many of these things happen. If you encounter it here, you could see, for example, falsifying documents to cross a border. You could see kidnapping, which would include transportation, transfer, and harboring. You could find illegal imprisonment. All of these are criminal offenses under the Russian Criminal Code, and a law enforcement agent would not be wrong to charge those. If you encounter it as an officer in the exploitation stage, there is not a circle that is long enough to cover all of this. There are so many things that you might see that are also crimes according to Russian law. You might see rape. You might see organizing prostitution if you encounter people in a brothel. You might see in administrative offenses of engaging in prostitution whereby the prostitute is actually fined. You could just see a lot of things. It's only as a law enforcement agent if you are able to step all the way back, you know, and see the whole picture that you were able to even see human trafficking, the crime, as happening during this time. So where you encounter it in this process really makes a huge difference. And according to the law, as long as exploitation happens, all you need to do is prove one of the other things. Buying and selling stands by itself. So if that happens, again, as I said, you have no problems if you're a law enforcement agent. But all you have to prove, I mean all, it's hard, but all you have to prove is that exploitation occurred along with one of these other things. But if you don't put those two things together in your mind as a law enforcement agent, you're going to see any one of these other crimes based on where you encounter the situation. So the formal criteria are actually quite difficult to apply. Informal criteria. Everybody has their own idea about what human trafficking is and what it looks like and what a typical victim looks like and what a typical perpetrator looks like. And law enforcement is no exception. They bring these stereotypes to the table when they're encountering a situation. They're trying to decide what is this a situation of. So things that have come up very frequently was, did the person have the ability to escape? Of course, people don't leave a situation for a variety of reasons. Sometimes they don't have documents. Sometimes they're physically held. Sometimes there are psychological things that hold them there, like threats to themselves, their families. And so, but nevertheless, this criteria in law enforcement's mind essentially says that, well, they didn't try to escape, therefore they must not have been held physically, therefore it shouldn't be trafficking. Likewise with voluntariness, this is especially in terms of prostitution. Did this person accept this job, knowing what this job was going to be? If they did, they can't possibly be a victim of trafficking, again, in law enforcement's mind. The law does not say that, and especially the international protocol does not say that. But yet, this is another way that they apply informal criteria to take out cases that could otherwise be considered trafficking. And last, did they receive any money? Any money at all makes it so it's not exploitation in the eyes of law enforcement. And that's a real problem because traffickers have gotten wise to that. And so now, instead of completely exploiting people and giving them nothing, they give them a little bit, and then law enforcement, upon looking at this situation, can then say, well, you got paid something. It wasn't a huge amount, but so they're able to sort of say, well, this isn't a trafficking situation. So these informal criteria really do shape the way that law enforcement encounter these situations. And then you combine that with the complexity of the formal criteria, and you can see that it's very difficult for law enforcement to apply these laws. But again, if we get past that stage, and we've identified it as human trafficking, there's still a lot of evidence that needs to be gathered. And new laws, as it turns out, or laws in general, don't really come with a great instruction manual that says, if you have the following 10 pieces of evidence, you will have an airtight case, a judge will believe it's trafficking, the prosecutors will believe it's trafficking. And so, especially in the early years, when I was doing a lot of this research, they were really struggling to know what it was that was going to prove trafficking. And you can see this from these quotes from some of my police officer informants and prosecutors. The real problem is that the evidence is unpredictable. There's no common formula for what works because nothing is outlined. Or the prosecutor, with murder, we know how to get the evidence. We know what kinds of forensics to do, the expert analyses to order, and how to prove the case. With human trafficking, it's a lot harder. In particular, this is important when we lay this onto the institutional incentives, which I'll talk about in just a minute. With increased practice, over time, these evidentiary criteria are becoming clearer. And so they're starting to know, for example, with the buying and selling, that if you can capture it on video and you see the money and the person change hands, whether that's a baby or an adult, bam, that's your case. So they figured that one out. They figured out that if you get victim testimony to prove that exploitation has taken place, that can be very, very helpful. They figured out that if you collect documentary and other physical evidence from, for example, a place of prostitution, bookkeeping records, passports that are held in a safe, these kinds of things can also be helpful indicators that trafficking has taken place. So they're starting to sort of coalesce around a certain set of evidentiary standards that are becoming more and more common. But the most common of those is the buying and selling. And because it's so easy, this video transaction, if you can capture it, that has really been what they've focused the most on. So these are all things that are specific in some way to the crime of human trafficking. And I'd like to turn in the time I have left to talking a little bit about the law enforcement incentive structures and their institutions. So Russian law enforcement, and this I think is really the key to understanding the way that they have worked on trafficking cases and the way that they work more generally. They have a very, very strict set of assessment criteria. And these assessment criteria apply to each different type of law enforcement agent a little bit differently, but for the most part, they're very common across law enforcement agencies. This is a system of performance assessment and accountability. And it relies primarily on quantitative indicators. So the three most important indicators for a Russian law enforcement agent are the following: cases cleared, comparison to the previous year, and time limits. Now, each individual agent's work is aggregated up the hierarchy of Russian law enforcement. So the collection of individual agents then either makes the department head look good or the department head look bad. So there's a lot of pressure from above to make sure that these things are constantly improving. The cases cleared is probably the most important, the single most important assessment criteria. And a case cleared is just that you've figured out your part of the thing and moved it forward through the system. And these sort, you know, all of these things, again, are measured in these quantitative numbers. How many were opened, how many were cleared. Whatever the difference is your failing. It's pretty simple, based on the numbers. This, of course, means that right away, any law enforcement agent who is at all thoughtful is going to assess what the likelihood of that case getting cleared is. And that sometimes happens in consultation with somebody beyond, either higher up or somebody like a prosecutor who might then be in charge of taking that case forward or might be able to change the charge. But for the most part, people right off the bat, whenever they see whatever they see, are trying to make a decision, will this case get cleared? For example, if somebody steals a mobile phone from you and you go to the police to report it, this is like a nightmare for them because, as we all know, you are never going to find whoever stole your mobile phone, and they're going to be stuck with an open case. And so they will do everything in their power to not even register that case. They will like say, oh, this is such a tragedy, or they could just say, like, get out. They could say, this is such a tragedy. We will look really hard for that person. Give us your phone number. We'll give you a call if we find that person, and we'll add your complaint to all the other mobile phones that they've probably stolen. And they have all of these sort of tried and true ways to avoid registering a case so they don't have that differential between open cases and cases cleared. The second big thing is comparison to the previous year. So every year, how many cases of X do you have? So how many cases of murder? I mean, that's maybe not a good one. You want to prevent that. How many cases of whatever it is? How many cases of rape? How many cases of trafficking? If you are, again, a law enforcement agent who responds to these incentives, as everybody does, when you have your number for this year, right next to that column in your statistical reporting sheet is the number from the previous year and the percentage increase or decrease. So it's pretty obvious whether you've done better or worse every year. And the pressure, of course, is to go up, not down. You do not want a negative 50% next to your number for this year. And so, again, this sort of pushes them at that initial encounter point to make a decision about whether this is going to be cleared. Because woe be it to the person who makes five, or the region who makes five human trafficking arrests this year, and then has to somehow top that with six next year. It's not great. You don't want to be those people. And then the final issue here in the institutional incentives is the time limits. The Russian Criminal Procedure Code places very strict time limits on the amount of time a case can be investigated for. It's 2 months. If you go beyond 2 months, you have to ask a superior for an extension. If you ask a superior for an extension, you get more attention. You don't want more attention. You want to sort of quietly go along with your thing, close your cases, get them processed. If you have to go beyond the additional set of time that they give you, you have to go even higher in the hierarchy to ask for an extension, all of which brings more attention to your department, to your agency. And that draws attention that is unwanted. What this all sort of works together to create is a situation in which law enforcement agents want cases that are easy to investigate, have fairly certain chances of conviction, and can be completed in a timely manner. So they will do tons, for example, to deal with this problem, they'll do tons of investigative activity before they actually open the case to try to figure all that stuff out. Then by the time they actually open it, they can put it together in 2 months and get it sent on its way. So these sorts of things create all kinds of incentives, or for, in the case of human trafficking cases, disincentives for actually focusing on them. Of course, as in any good law enforcement system, all of, and any good, especially Russian system, all of this is documented to the letter. Anywhere that these things fall apart, you know exactly where they fell apart. So again, this is, you know, you spend a lot of time on paperwork, and if there's this difference between cases open and cases cleared, it's really clear whose fault that is. And again, you don't want that if you are a law enforcement agent. You don't want additional attention focused on you, focused on your department. The other piece, or pieces, I guess, of the institutional incentives are things that we tend to think already about Russian law enforcement. We know a lot. The institutional culture of corruption. A lot of, once that becomes institutionalized and things work faster when you've done them in a corrupt way, it becomes very hard to undo that. The other thing, though, is the institutional structure and culture. So agents are socialized into a very strict military-like hierarchy, and that system punishes any initiative. Even if you are doing it for the good of the case, your hierarchy trumps everything. So the chain of command trumps everything. And you can get in trouble for disobeying what your superior has said. This really limits officers' ability to be creative, to take initiative, which is something that often needs to happen in human trafficking cases because of the complexity. And so these sorts of things are also a problem. I'll also mention the division of functions. So there are a number of different people in Russian law enforcement who will handle a case. This is an incredibly simplified version that is only relevant for trafficking cases of a much larger system that would take like several walls worth of diagrams to actually show what happens. But the basic idea is this. The first person who might encounter a trafficking case is the operativnik, the operative agent. These are sort of the on-the-ground detective-y types who are collecting evidence, taking preliminary statements, performing searches. They're the ones who have confidential informants. And when they encounter something, they don't just say like, oh, hey, here's a thing. They kind of know what they're looking at, and they're gonna know what the people further on down the line are gonna consider to be good evidence. And so this stage of the game is overseen by a prosecutor in a very sort of abstract way, but if it all goes according to plan and there are no complaints, usually the prosecutor does not sort of reach down to muck around with what the operative agents are doing. When they get all of the information, which again, they're not doing in a vacuum, they have some idea of what they're doing, they pass that on to an investigator who is either, if it is simple trafficking with no aggravating factors in the police, the MVD, or an investigator in the investigative committee. Before 2007, this went to investigators in the procuracy. Since the investigative committee was formed, they now go to the investigative committee. This is where most of the investigation of trafficking cases happens because it is really rare that you find trafficking without aggravating factors of some sort. So the investigator takes all of the information and compiles it into an admissible set of documents, so which is called the case file. If the operativnik followed the criminal procedure code in gathering all of the things, great, those things go right into the case file. If not, then the investigator can request that they do the investigation again, or not the investigation, but pieces of the investigation again, according to what the criminal procedure code requires, so that all of that evidence can go in the case file. If you notice this little arrow, if aggravating factors come up when the MVD has been, the police have been investigating, they are obligated to send that to the investigative committee. It cannot go the other way. So if it turns out that they don't have enough evidence to prove one of those aggravating factors, it can't go back to the MVD. The investigative committee is stuck with it. Once that happens, the prosecutor approves the charges and then sends it on to a separate prosecutor who is going to actually bring the case to court on behalf of the state. At each step in this chain, the person who receives the case, it has the power to change the charge. So if an operative agent collects all the stuff that indicates human trafficking and passes it to the investigator who has a different idea of what that law says or a different understanding of what the formal criteria are, sorry, operative guy, you've spent a lot of time on something that's not going to go forward as trafficking. Likewise, on down the line, all the way to the courtroom prosecutor who literally just receives the case file and has to go and deal with it in court, they can look through it and they can be like, oh, no way, I'm not winning on that charge, and they can refuse to support the human trafficking charge. Now, usually trafficking cases are brought with multiple charges, and so the case will often go forward without the trafficking charge, but it loses some symbolic meaning if you're not prosecuting trafficking as trafficking, but instead are trying to prosecute it as something else. In other words, trafficking cases are a lot of work. And if you don't have the right incentive structures to pursue them, you are not going to. And the way that the law enforcement agencies are set up in Russia creates a huge incentive not to pursue human trafficking. So, given all this, you're probably unsurprised when I tell you that Russian law enforcement has not, in fact, pursued a lot of human trafficking cases. However, not all is lost. And my happy moment of this whole project is talking about this, the moment of optimism in Russian law enforcement. Law enforcement has been finding alternative ways to prosecute human trafficking cases. Given how difficult the formal criteria are, given that they are struggling with what kinds of evidence a judge might find acceptable, given all of these difficulties, they've decided to take all of those lower columns in that picture of the law that I showed you and use those laws instead. So according to a police officer in Moscow, about half the cases that we prosecute under 240, which is the recruitment into prostitution statute, are actually could just as easily be human trafficking. That's Article 127.1. We can either do 10 cases of recruitment into prostitution or one case of human trafficking. And we want to prosecute more and get them cleared more quickly. The punishments are only a little bit different. So why should we try any harder? I was like, well, that is the most honest thing that anybody has ever said to me. This was the last day of my field research. And I was like, oh, voila, we have figured out the problem. Another police officer said, we've had no cases of human trafficking. We usually just begin investigations under recruitment into prostitution, just in case, which explains why we don't even bother to use the human trafficking charge. In this guy's mind, these two things are totally equivalent. And the statistics bear this out. So these are actual MVD statistics. The line here represents when the human trafficking law was passed. And you can see the huge jump in cases that are sort of about facilitating prostitution. These are things that can be used as an alternative to human trafficking for sex trafficking. I should be specific. You can see here it goes from 96 cases the year before to 276. It's a huge jump in recruitment into prostitution, 356 to 976 in terms of organization of prostitution. I argue this is not because Russian law enforcement has all of a sudden decided that prostitution is really, really bad and needs to be a target. This is entirely spurred by the passage of the human trafficking laws. And then most people have a question about what happened there after 2008. One, the MVD reorganized and the prosecuting service reorganized into the investigative committee. There was a lot of confusion about who was going to be reporting to who. And so when that happens, everybody panics and nobody does anything, or everything slows down. But also, importantly, primarily true for prostitution rings, but when you bust a prostitution ring, it takes some time to reform. And so, reform in both ways, reform. it takes some time. So as you're busting more and more of them, it becomes harder to actually recreate them in the same locations with the same people. Your people have been carted off to jail. You've got to have new people. They've got to stake out new territory. And so you tend to see these start to fall off after a certain period of time. So this is the positive optimistic note that I'd like to end with. And I would be delighted to take questions from all of you. Thank you so much for this opportunity. Yes, the timing was good. Should I take my own questions? Does anybody have any questions? Yoey?
I have a couple of questions. I had to write them down. So one thing you mentioned about, it's kind of a minor thing, but I was about the ability to leave if you're trafficked out of the country. What is the legal status of somebody that's, let's say, trafficked somewhere into Europe if they don't have documents and they're in, I don't know, Germany or something, then what is it? What are they? What's their status?
So if they're not identified as a trafficking victim in Germany, they're illegal and they're deported. And if you're illegal and you're deported, you get the deportation stamp on your passport. That's a real problem for ever traveling abroad again. So there, you know, if you know, Germany has plenty of sort of programs for trafficking victims if they are found and identified as trafficking victims, but if they're not, they're considered to be there illegally. So. Yes, in the back.
Yeah, what are the defense attorneys like for these defendants, trafficker defendants? I mean, to what extent do them having a good criminal defense attorney, to what extent does that help them or dissuade, let's say, the prosecutors from believing they can win these trafficking cases? Because it's, you know, based on my understanding, the conviction rates are pretty high in Russia for most criminal charges. So is it essentially that structure of the elements, you know, the trafficking charge that dissuades them? Defense attorneys have any role in this?
So I would say defense attorneys in Russia, generally speaking, play a very small role. Traditionally, it hasn't been an adversarial system. It has moved towards an adversarial system, but they still haven't quite taken on this sort of vigorous defense role. That said, traffickers usually make a lot of money, and they will hire the best. In the case that I went to in Yoshkar-Ala, the prosecutors were telling me, like, these are the best lawyers in town. Like, this was hard. And so I wouldn't say that ordinarily I don't think that law enforcement in those early stages would be dissuaded by the prospect of facing off against a difficult defense attorney. So I still think the institutional incentives hold there. But I do think that there is, because of the uncertainty of what the formal criteria of the law mean, there is a lot of room for a clever, if you can afford one, of like the three in Russia that actually vigorously advocate for their clients in this way. If you can afford that and you find that person, there are many ways to argue the formal criteria of the trafficking law to your advantage. Ted.
So I have a more general question about police. This system you described of incentives to where they're rewarded or punished based on their rate of clearing cases has been criticized again and again by human rights activists who are becoming an endangered species in Russia. But nonetheless, there's been this long-term sense that this contributes to the level of corruption and violence, because obviously it gives the police an incentive to get false confessions by beating the crap out of suspects. Is there any movement within the Russian government or legal system or police authorities or the police, you know, reach out to talk to change this system? I mean, is there a recognition at least that this is part of the problem? Or is it just sort of like, well, this is just how we do things, we've always done it this way, too bad?
I mean, so the answer is yes, there's a recognition, and no one has come up with a good solution to fix it. So I think there is a deep concern that if you take this away, you have no control. So whatever entrenched culture of corruption that exists already becomes even more difficult to manage and regulate if you don't have something at least that, you know, you can monitor the lower level police. There have been a lot of discussions about maybe, whether this is ever going to happen. There's a lot of people that benefit from this. And so like anything, it's difficult to, when there are people in high places that benefit from these sorts of things. I mean, one of the things about the statistics is if you hit your target, then you're free to do whatever you want, right? So you, if you're the traffic police, you hit your target of like 10 traffic stops this week. Everything after that, that's money in your pocket. And so it has perverse, it creates perverse incentives in a lot of ways. But the thing is, I think they're worried that if they take it away entirely, they literally have no way to control anybody. And that's, they've not been able to figure out some sort of middle ground. As far, I mean, there have been tons of proposals. There, Vadim Volkov's institute up in St. Petersburg is working on this all the time. And you know, they come up with ideas, but there's a lot of entrenched power in the police that is not that interested, because the cut of everything that happens over a cut that of every all those additional traffic stops that you make goes up the hierarchy. And so the corruption and these indicators are so deeply interwoven that it would be really hard to just overturn the entire system. The interests are too entrenched, and there's not anywhere close to enough political will to do that. But they do, they recognize it's a problem, they just don't, they're terrified of like a free-for-all, basically, if they were to remove any kind of quantitative assessment mechanisms. Anton.
I'm curious how this push to prosecute human trafficking translates into prosecution cases. I mean, if the Russian legal system really wants to do something, there is usually some kind of document. For instance, Supreme Court gets some, institutes some general instructions, and then it gets much easier.
Mm-hmm.
So if that some sort of that sort of thing didn't happen in this case, so how? And how these officers understand that they should prosecute this case?
So two things. So you're right about the Supreme Court. One of the things that I heard over and over again is there's not enough practice for the Supreme Court to issue a postanovlenie, this kind of clarifying document about how you should prosecute cases and what you should do. And therefore, there will be no more cases because we're terrified that we don't know what to do. So this ended up being kind of a vicious circle that people described quite frequently. But what does get them to prosecute cases is pulling out the statute from the general group of crimes that fall under crimes against bodily integrity, or what, I can't remember what exactly the section is of the criminal code. So now human trafficking has its own line. And if you fill that box with zeros every year, that doesn't look good. And so there is some impetus, and that was a big push, actually, very cleverly by a lot of the people who were advocating on behalf of sort of human trafficking prosecutions, and we need to do something about this, was suggesting to the MVD that you split out this crime from the broader category. So now you can see that year after year, and that's why we have, in my opinion, that's why we have any trafficking cases at all, is because there's just enough pressure to do something. I should also mention that these indicators are, in many ways, they can be a stimulus to do things, right? So you pull out one line and you have a box that you now have to fill of human trafficking cases specifically. But, you know, take for example, and I use this example in the book, and people were like, wait, what? Take for example the law on extremism. These, if the political will is there and people want, and the higher ups want more and more cases, this incentive system can be a huge stimulus to get those cases, right? And then you have law enforcement agents running around, you know, charging people with extremism that haven't really done anything extremist whatsoever, but they've been motivated by needing to fill those boxes. And so it can work in both ways. It can work at, the incentive structure can work with some political will to create a whole bunch of cases that the government or the, you know, the police want. It can also work in the opposite way, which is to disincentivize because it's clear that there is no political will to do this. Yoey.
Just following that, isn't there an incentive to have some of these things go down to zero? Because the overall number of cases it's not millions. So it's not inconceivable that you would have zero, that you could achieve zero cases in some regions or cities or something like that. So is there any larger incentive to, I mean, just thinking of the general way that they like to present things in statistics there, why wouldn't the best base be you have reduced the number of murders, you've reduced the number of cases overall, rather than you increase them each year?
I think that's a great question. I think probably because everybody knows that you're not going to reduce it to zero. And so zero looks like you're not doing anything. And like that, you know, that's sort of, nobody believes that there are actually, I mean, it is believable that in like the Nimitz Republic that there are zero human trafficking cases. And indeed there are zero human trafficking cases there for the entire time. But in some place like, you know, St. Petersburg, zero year after year, like nobody believes that. And in St. Petersburg is one of the poorest, like for the number of people there and the number of people we would guess that are trafficked in and around and out of St. Petersburg, they are terrible. They really don't put in a huge amount of effort there at all on this. And so I think that part of it is that zero is just not a believable number unless you're in a particular region where it could be believable. Yes?
I had a question on the child trafficking cases.
Yeah.
Are most of those, when the prosecutors say that they were selling the children who were in turn passed on to foreigners outside the country?
So that's the narrative, but the reality is there's not a single case that they've prosecuted that follows that narrative. So the fear is great that the babies are being sold to foreigners, but when it actually comes down to sort of, you know, getting down to brass tacks, the reality is they have had zero cases in which the parents that they've arrested have been selling to foreigners. There's sometimes like, oh, well, maybe there were some more babies that we just didn't find because they were sold to foreigners. But the majority of the child selling cases are not trafficking rings, which still tend to sell within Russia. But there are these desperate parents who are like putting up advertisements on the internet who are like, I will sell my baby. Please, somebody take my baby. They're desperate. And so those are not cases in which, you know, they're looking for foreign buyers. They're just trying to get rid of the child. So, but the narrative is incredibly powerful that they're all being sold to foreign parents. They're all going to get abused and or killed by those foreign adoptive parents. And we have to protect our Russian babies. And that's why there's such a huge push to prosecute these child trafficking cases. The other reason they are good at child trafficking cases is because of that buying and selling transaction, right? It's super easy if you manage to figure out that this is going to happen to go undercover, pretend you're a desperate couple looking for a baby, and give some money, get the baby, tape it on video, the end. There was one case I looked at where there were only three pieces of evidence necessary for the conviction: the video, the birth certificate, and the marked money that changed hands, and that was it. So it's super easy because most of those actions, unlike sex trafficking and labor trafficking, where victims are not generally exchanged in a monetary transaction, sort of one-to-one, the child trafficking cases are almost all like that. So they're easy too for law enforcement. Andy.
Is there any evidence about, and I'm sure it's incomplete and not perfect if it exists, about what has actually happened to incidents of trafficking, not prosecutions, not the legal establishment since the 2003 law?
Like, has the incident?
Like, have there been studies that have like estimated, like, you know, I mean, maybe there is less sex trafficking. In Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Is there, and that's why there's less part of it. I mean, is there any good evidence about this, or is it just really?
It's mostly anecdotal. It's not. The numbers have never been good. It's one of the most frustrating things about researching human trafficking. Actually, is that there's no sort of denominator to figure out, like, what percentage of this number are being prosecuted. You just have no idea what the denominator is. I think anecdotally, based on you know, non-government organizations that I've talked to and people who are working on trafficking, they say that the methods have changed quite significantly, not necessarily, sometimes because of the law. So I mentioned the thing about compensation. Mm-hmm. So they figured out quite quickly, the traffickers did, that this might be a loophole that they could exploit in informal understandings of what trafficking was. So they've changed their methods that way. They've changed the methods of recruitment. So if they're recruiting, they're not recruiting anymore for like nannies and babysitters. They're recruiting for people to essentially, you know, work at a restaurant or a bar and try to get people to buy drinks through, you know, acting and flirting and those kinds of things. And always in those negotiations, the discussion is, well, if you're interested, you can provide sexual services on the side. And so they've changed the kinds of people that they're recruiting to people who might be interested in making additional money in that way. And so they've changed around a lot of the tactics, but I think the overall numbers, it's really hard to know. I think with the, you know, economic boom in the 2000s, more labor trafficking, more women staying in Russia and looking for work in Russia, and so more domestic trafficking. But the hard numbers don't really exist. The anecdotal evidence is that during that time, things went less international, more domestic in terms of sex trafficking, labor trafficking, more international, just as much domestic probably. I think now it's going to be very interesting. The refugee crisis in Ukraine, refugee issues are refugee camps, refugees who have no security of living, all these sorts of things. They're very vulnerable to trafficking situations. So I think it's going to be kind of interesting to see how things pan out over the next couple of years. Yes?
Did Russia sign or ratify the ILO Convention on Slave Labor?
I cannot remember if they have or have not. I think they have. I'm like 90% sure that they have.
Because one of the places where you might see some additional data is the Committee of Expert Reports, because mm-hmm. for the ILO, any sort of, if you ratify, then you have to provide a report either every year or every other year. And the Committee of Experts will have their observations, which is your government, you say X, and the Committee of Experts can turn around and say,
right.
And we want more information. And
right.
We'll simply yell about this and tell you to either fix it or...
Yeah, I'll have to look at that. I cannot remember offhand whether they have ratified it or not.
The United States has not.
So. Yeah, well, I mean, have we ratified anything?
183.
Yes. So, yeah, I'll definitely take a look at that. Thank you. Yeah, no, I don't. I know that the definition that they use of various labor violations that are akin to slave labor comes from a lot of the ILO stuff. But
it would just be interesting because Putin's been on a ratification, an ILO convention ratification kick since, like, what, 2012, when he did that big speech in front of the ILO.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I'll have to check into it. I'm not sure offhand.
I was just curious about the labor trafficking, if there's been any sort of big cases that have been prosecuted that got some media attention, because I know it's tied in with this anti-migrant sentiment that some have argued has been on the rise in the last 3 or 4 years, let's say, and then, you know, the public, when people write, like Beauty and Yeba, they say, oh, well, you know, they're we're mad about the fact that there are these illegal migrants and the police are participating in this process with the inclusion of the employers of allowing them to bring these people in and take our jobs and take our women and this and that. You know. So has there been any splashy
scandals? There have been a couple of splashy ones. That didn't lead to prosecution. so there was a real splashy one in Moscow about 2 or 3 years ago. That was, I think, 7 or 8 Central Asian women from various different Central Asian countries working in slave conditions in a grocery store. They were rescued by an organization called Alternativa, which has been doing these kinds of rescue efforts, and they were not prosecuted. It was not prosecuted for whatever reasons. But I think that, I think you're exactly right about the anti-migrant sentiment. I think one of the things that is unfortunate is that the cases of slave labor that do have migrants as victims are just not as sympathetic to the Russian public, and they're not as sympathetic to the police. For, you know, sometimes for corrupt reasons, sometimes for non-corrupt reasons, but they're just...
These conscript cases, I mean, you also hear anecdotally about this all the time.
Yeah.
There's just no effort to crack down or to make an example of Officer X for particularly egregious...
If they do it, they tend to prosecute under abuse of authority, which is not... I mean, it's a criminal violation, but it's the sentencing is much less. It's a slap on the wrist. And so when they do prosecute, they prosecute under that. Usually it's like, okay, you've like lost rank and you can't work in the, you know, you can't work as an officer for like 2 years. And maybe you'll spend like 3 months in jail. I mean, it's really, really low stakes. And so a lot of the, like the Committee on Soldiers' Mothers has sent an open letter to the Prosecutor General saying, you gotta start using the slave labor law. Like, you can use this. And various, you know, splashy cases of this type, you'll see human rights activists come out saying, like, this should be considered slave labor. All the evidence is here, but that's just not, it's not in their world. They just can't conceptualize these things as the same, like, that it's not, they're already conscripts, so maybe it's not even possible that it could be slave labor. They just cannot conceptualize. There's been one case where the slave labor statute was used in one of these cases.
And was it a successful prosecution?
It was, but there was no evidence about, I couldn't find any reports on what the actual sentence was. And the prosecution was not of the military guy, it was of the other guy. So the guy who used the soldier as slave labor, not the military guy who exchanged the soldier.
Inciting slavery, not actually...
Right, exactly. So.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
I think that sort of touches on something I've been thinking through this lecture. Is it seems like the quote-unquote victims of prosecution are mostly the lower classes. You know, because like high-class prostitutes, I doubt, are not going to be affected by prosecution of the Reef Laws. People that are running prostitutes are probably the lower echelon of people. People that are real organizers never touch the money, never get on the vehicle. So it seems to me like this is really affecting them, in a sense, the people who need the money the most.
So most of the time, actually, with the trafficking cases, they're not bringing in the prostitutes. And they're not bringing in the migrants and prosecuting them for illegal documents or whatever. So occasionally that happens, but not that often with the trafficking cases. What is true, though, is that the people who end up in these situations as victims have changed quite significantly. From the 90s, they were a lot of very, very well-educated women who were looking for work abroad and fell into these situations. Now they are recruiting much lower class, people from difficult homes, difficult family lives, people who are in debt, people who nobody will bother looking for when they go missing. And that has changed quite significantly from the 90s and the way that people are being recruited. But in these cases that I've looked at in particular, they're not usually, the people who are victims are usually designated by law as victims. And there's, even if you're designated by law as a victim, there's not a huge amount of stuff that you get to be if you are a victim, but they are usually considered to be victims. Yeah?
You have discussed the human trafficking domestically and from Russia to European or other countries. I wonder, like, what is the human trafficking into Russia? What is the situation for that and how to come to the response?
So the trafficking into Russia exists on a smaller scale, at least in terms of what law enforcement has been pursuing. There have been women trafficked into Russia for sex from Ukraine, from Central Asia, from Asia. There have been laborers trafficked into Russia from Ukraine, Moldova, Central Asia. So there are quite a number of these cases, but they're less, they tend to be less, and often they're sent back to their home countries. The cases themselves are sent back to their home countries. So there were a number of cases in which the exploiter and the person who was exploited were both Uzbek citizens, and though the exploitation took place in Russia, and though they could have just, they had jurisdiction over that case, they sent the whole case back to Uzbekistan to be prosecuted and dealt with there. Likewise, a lot of cases from Ukraine, or a lot of cases come out of Ukraine, they're stopped at the border by Russian border guards, they go back to Ukraine and get prosecuted there. So a lot of it has been sort of, I don't want to say outsourced, that's not quite the word I'm looking for, but they've given those things back to the countries that they came from.
So will they send the victim back to their country? Like without going through the trial, just directly send them back?
Usually, yeah. Russia is the worst of the post-Soviet region on victim protection. If you were to sort of rank, Russia would be like at the bottom by like 3 feet. The IOM, the International Organization for Migration, ran a shelter for 3 years trying to show the need. They had like 400 victims go through the shelter in 3 years. The Russian government was like, no, looks like there's no need, and didn't sort of take over running the shelter. So Russia is very, very bad at helping victims when they do find them. Mostly they just get sent home. Any other questions? All right, thank you all so much.